Well, I should say thank you all for coming to listen to me. This business of giving talks, it's a two-way thing, of course, isn't it? You have to be here, otherwise there's no point, yeah? So this is a mutual exploration of this topic, the topic of spiritual friendship, or Kalyana Mitrata, as we usually say. So I suspect most of you will have heard the story from the Pali Canon, where the Buddha, where Ananda comes to the Buddha and says, "I have, what does he say? Something like, I've found out that spiritual friendship is half the spiritual life." And the Buddha says, "Say not so, Ananda, say not so. It's the whole of the spiritual life." So I'm just going to read this, how it's put in the Pali Canon. It's from the part of the Pali Canon called the Sanyutta Nikaya. It says, "Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling among the Shakyans, where there was a town of the Shakyans named Nagaraka. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down to one side and said to him, 'Venerable Sir, this is half of the holy life, that is, good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship.' 'Not so, Ananda, not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life, Ananda, that is, good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. And how, Ananda, does a bhikkhu who has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path? Here, Ananda, a bhikkhu develops right view, which is based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, maturing in release. He develops right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. It is in this way, Ananda, that a bhikkhu who has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, develops and cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path. By following the method too, Ananda, it may be understood how the entire holy life is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. By relying upon me as a good friend, Ananda, beings subject to birth are freed from birth. Beings subject to aging are freed from aging. Beings subject to death are freed from death. Beings subject to sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair are freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair." So one thing you notice is the Pali Canon is very repetitive. Yeah? Anyway, I realized some time back that although I was very, very familiar with this story, I'd heard it many times, I'd heard people say it in talks and so on, I had only accepted it, I think, on a very superficial level. I'm not sure I'd ever fully believed it, in a way. Did the Buddha really mean that spiritual friendship was the whole of the spiritual life? So this talk is an opportunity to reflect on this exchange between the Buddha and Ananda and explore what it might mean, in practice, if one was to fully accept and act on this assertion that spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. But I think we really need to start by thinking about, well, what is it that we're talking about? Clarify, what do we mean, for instance, by spiritual life? Yeah. So that's what I want to start with. If we're talking about spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata being the whole of the spiritual life, we need to know what we mean by spiritual life. After that, I'll go on and explore what the Buddha meant by Kalyana Mitrata, by spiritual friendship. And hopefully, by the end, I'll be able to explain how spiritual friendship is indeed the whole of the spiritual life. So in this particular sutta, this phrase that's being used for spiritual life is brahmacharya. And it's worth noting that brahmacharya, spiritual life, is not a literal translation of brahmacharya. Brahmacharya is an image, and spiritual life is a concept. So Brahma is, in Indian mythology, Brahma is the king of the gods. So Brahma stands for what's highest in the universe. From a Buddhist perspective, that which is highest isn't, of course, Brahma. It's Nirvana, it's Buddhahood, it's enlightenment. So the Brahmacharya, we could say, is the Buddhacharya. Charya meaning the way or the path or the practices or the means to enlightenment. So the Brahmacharya is really the Buddhacharya, or you could even say the Bodhicharya, Bodhi meaning awakening. Actually, we've come across, some of you who've studied Buddhism will have come across Bodhicharya. Our sevenfold puja is based on the Bodhicharya avatara. So the Bodhicharya is the way or the means or the methods leading to awakening, Bodhi meaning awakening. So if we say Kalyana Mitrata is the whole of the spiritual life, it's the whole of the Brahmacharya, this means it's the whole of the Bodhicharya. It's the whole of the way or the means to awakening, to enlightenment. So that the means and the end are not separate. The end, as it were, is included in the means. So that which is the whole of the way is also the whole of the goal, you could say. Just for the sake of completion, just to say there are other terms in the Pali canon which sometimes get translated as spiritual life or whatever. Terms like pabbajitena, which is the going forth, or niramisa, which is unworldly, or aryaparyesana, the noble quest. So all of these are terms used in the Pali canon, which we use the shorthand of spiritual life or spiritual practice for. So the question arises when we talk about the way to Buddhahood or the way to awakening or whatever, what is awakening? What do we mean by awakening? And again, it's worth noting that it's an image. It's a metaphor of waking up from sleep. Shakespeare, of course, says, "Our little life is rounded by a sleep." However, the Buddha says, "Our life is one big sleep." Yeah, and we need to wake up. So the metaphor of sleep and waking only works partially. It doesn't really work fully as a metaphor, because of course we cannot stay awake permanently in a literal sense. Yeah, so it doesn't really fully work. Sleep is essential to our well-being, whereas awakening, bodhi, is. The awakening is also essential to our well-being, but is permanent when it's reached. It's not possible, as it were, to go back into the sleep of ignorance. Yeah, and ignorance, of course, is not essential to our well-being. Yeah. So what the metaphor of awakening, what it's really doing, is trying to give us a feeling for the experience of realization or spiritual awakening. It's trying to give us a feeling for the experience by saying it's like waking up. It's like waking up from a deep sleep. It's contrasting two states, you could say, the two states that we're familiar with, the state of sleep and the state of wakefulness. And it's doing that just to give us a hint of what Bodhi is like as an experience. Nirvana, by the way, is also a metaphor. Nirvana is about blowing out a fire, as it were. So it's blowing out the fires of the passions of greed, hatred, and ignorance. And of course, enlightenment is another metaphor. It's about bringing light into darkness. And after his awakening, after his enlightenment, the Buddha spoke of his experience in terms of liberation from the rounds of rebirth, or liberation from suffering, and which is another metaphor in a way. He also spoke in terms of the house builder who had been seen and could no longer build the house, an image of you could say, of discovery or revelation or something like that. And in terms of concepts, probably the most familiar description of the Buddha's insight is what we call Pratichasamutpada, which is translated as the law of dependent origination. Basically what it's saying is that everything arises in dependence upon conditions and ceases when those conditions cease. In other words, what the Buddha saw, or what the Buddha understood or experienced or woke up to, is the fact that everything is impermanent and insubstantial. Nothing has a fixed, permanent essence. Everything is impermanent and insubstantial. And the brahmacharya, the spiritual life, the bodhicharya, is the way or the means leading to this insight into our experience of the nature of reality. So the spiritual life is the life that is lived as a means to this insight, the life that's lived as a means to this vision, this experience, or this realization of reality. So when we say that spiritual friendship, or kalyana mitrata, is all of the spiritual life, we're making a definite link, a definite connection between spiritual friendship and this reality of Pratichasamutpada. A definite link is being made between spiritual friendship and impermanence and insubstantiality. You could say a definite link is being made between spiritual friendship and all those metaphors pointing to the Buddha's experience, awakening, nirvana, bringing light into darkness, liberation from suffering, and so on. All these are linked to kalyana mitrata, to spiritual friendship. And the Buddha seems to be saying that it's the most essential element. It's the most essential element needed if we're to achieve this insight or realization. So from the perspective of the Buddha, it's really important that we get a grasp of what's meant by kalyana mitrata, what's meant by spiritual friendship. So what is meant? Well, mitrata means friendship. That's Sanskrit, by the way, not Pali. Mittata in Pali. And, of course, it's related to the word mitra, meaning a friend. And it's related to the word maitri, or metta, meaning friendliness. Yeah. In the dictionary, the Pali-English dictionary, kalyana mitra has two meanings. One very general meaning and one more technical. I've just quoted here from Subhuti, and Subhuti's written a book on spiritual friendship, and here's how he talks about kalyana mitrata. He says, the Pali Text Society's Pali English Dictionary offers two definitions of kalyana mitrata, or kalyana mitra. The first one is a good companion, a virtuous friend, an honest, pure friend. And such a friend is said to have faith, to be virtuous, learned, liberal, and wise. And in the second sense, a kalyana mitra is a spiritual guide or a spiritual advisor. So in this second case, there's clearly an unequal or a hierarchical aspect to the relationship. A guide must be someone whose spiritual knowledge and experience is superior to our own. So the phrase kalyana mitrata, or spiritual friendship, encompasses both these meanings. And this is what corresponds to what Bhante Sangharakshita calls horizontal and vertical Kalyanamitrata. So vertical friendship refers to the more hierarchical relationship between teacher and pupil. And the Buddha refers to himself in that bit I read out from the Pali Canon. He refers to himself as a Kalyanamitra, in the sense of a guide. Yeah. And this this word Kalyanamitra is often combined and synonymous with a couple of other phrases, Kalyana Sahayo and Kalyana Sampavanko. And they're translated as things like good associates, good companions, or good comrades. So it emphasizes personal relationship, that translation. It emphasizes good companions, good comrades, good associates, whatever. It emphasizes a personal relationship. There's a sutta called the Rhinoceros Horn Sutta, which is often taken to be an exhortation to live in solitude or seclusion. But actually, what the Buddha actually says there is something different. What he's saying is, if you can't find a good friend, then you should live in seclusion. Yeah. So this is how it goes. He says, if one finds a wise friend, a companion living according to good virtues, prudent, and having conquered all dangers, then live with them happily and mindfully. Certainly, we praise the acquisition of friendship and friends. Those who are either higher or equal in attainment or development should be associated with. Not finding such friends, enjoying blameless food, let one live alone. I'm not sure what blameless food is, by the way. It's probably being a vegetarian here. So this aspect of spiritual friendship as a personal relationship is emphasized on other occasions by the Buddha as well. So there's another story in the Pali Canon, in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha is giving a teaching to a man called Digajanu, who's one of his lay disciples, so not a monk. And he says, and what is good friendship? So that's Kalyanamitrata in the text. Here, in whatever village or town a family man dwells, he associates with householders or their sons, whether young or old, who are of mature virtue, accomplished in faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. He converses with them and engages in discussions with them. He emulates them in regard to their accomplishment in faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. This is called good friendship. And then there's another occasion when the Buddha is speaking to King Pasenadi. And basically he's telling the king the story of how Ananda came to him and told him that spiritual friendship was half the spiritual life and so on. And he tells the king about his response to Ananda. And then he goes on and he says, therefore, great king, you should train yourself thus. I will be one who has good friends, good companions, good comrades. It is in such a way that you should train yourself. So Kalyanamitrata, spiritual friendship, covers a whole spectrum of relationships, from friendship with peers, as it were, fellow aspirants who are pursuing the path alongside us, as it were. This is the spiritual community, whether it's a lay community or a community of monks or whatever. And that spectrum goes through to teachers and guides and awakened ones. So there's a whole spectrum of Kalyanamitrata, a whole spectrum of friendship from the Buddha down to somebody who's just walked in that door wanting to learn to meditate. Yeah. And the Buddha seems to be saying that all of this is essential. All of this wide spectrum of Kalyanamitrata, because he mentions all of it in his talk. He mentions himself as the guide, and he mentions the more, as it were, horizontal level of friendship. So he's saying all of this is essential. It's essential to awakening. It's the, as it were, it's the beginning, the middle, and the end of spiritual life. So I think to understand this better, we need to explore more deeply, in a bit more detail, what the Dharma life, the spiritual life, what's it really about? So the Buddha talks about his realization in terms of liberation from the rounds of rebirth. And he also speaks in all those other terms I talked about, like discovering the builder of the house of ignorance, or he talks about it as being like finding a lost city in a jungle. But then he does come back more conceptually to this idea of pratichitsamupada, this idea of the law of conditionality. How it's stated is, when this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that arises. So it sounds quite dry. It sounds almost like a mathematical formula or something like that when you read it. But this is the attempt to conceptualize one of the deepest realizations in Buddhism. This insight that everything arises in dependence upon conditions, and this insight is to be applied to our human predicament. So what is the human predicament? The human predicament is that our lives are unsatisfactory, and that the ways that we go about trying to find happiness and security don't work. And then we die. You know? Actually, Woody Allen puts it like this. I don't know how many of you have seen the film Annie Hall, but at the very beginning, Woody Allen says, "Life is full of loneliness and misery and suffering and unhappiness, and it's all over much too quickly." So that's the human predicament, according to Woody Allen style as well. Vishrapani, in his book on the life of the Buddha, Gautama, which some of you will have read, puts it in more Buddhist terms. He says dukkha being unsatisfactoriness, dukkha encompasses all the unsatisfactoriness that is inherent in life, and the sense that something is awry even when things go well. So for Gautama, this was more than a mild unease. It was a shattering awareness of aspects of reality he had previously ignored. He had a remarkable talent for identifying the universal truths in particular experiences, but he may have been helped by spiritual teachings heard in Kapilavastu. He later quoted powerful verses attributed to an ancient teacher called Araka, which say that human life vanishes as quickly as the dewdrop on the tip of a blade of grass, a bubble on the surface of the water, a line drawn on water, a river that has arisen far away in the mountains. The life of humans is brief and fleeting and full of pain and despair, the verses continue. You should heed advice, do what is wholesome, practice the spiritual life. There is no escape from death. So the question for Siddhartha, before he was the Buddha, the question for Siddhartha and the question for all thinking human beings is, what can we do about this state of affairs? What is life about really? That's the question. What is life about really? So dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness, arises in dependence upon conditions, like everything else. Therefore, if we can discover those conditions and eradicate them, we can destroy unsatisfactoriness. And when the Buddha looked deeply into his mind, he saw that craving and attachment, grasping and clinging, were root causes of suffering. So the question then becomes, how do you remove craving and attachment? How do you remove grasping and clinging from your mind? And craving and attachment are so strong because of this notion we have of a self, a fixed and permanent and substantial self. And this notion, which is the, as a word, a central ignorance, according to the Buddha, is the cause of suffering. And because of the notion of self, there's also a strong urge we have to protect that self, and that's what gives rise to aversion and hatred. So this is the, as it were, unholy threesome of belief in a self that's fixed and permanent, craving to satisfy that self, and aversion to protect that self. Yeah, these three are the causes of suffering. But these things go very, very deeply, and they can't be dismissed just by saying so. Yeah. First of all, it has to become ever more clear to the individual who wants to be free that this permanent fixed self is not real. This law of conditionality, pratichasamutpada, applies to the self. It says everything is in process, and what we think of as I or me is also a process. Yeah, it's an ever-changing process. So first we need to see that, and to see that we have to become aware of our own experience in more and more subtle ways. We have to become aware of what's happening in our own minds in more and more subtle ways. We need to become aware of the fact that we do have a notion of a fixed, permanent self. If we look at our experience, if we look at how we respond to the world, if we look at how we behave in the world, we'll realize that that is how we are. This sense of I or me or mine is very, very strong in us. Yeah. It's more than an idea. It's something that goes very deep. And part of what we need to become aware of is not just that we have that, but how we actually build it and how we enhance it and how we protect it and so on. However, there is a danger in this. There's a danger in this. If we spend a lot of time and energy on the self or the ego, trying to undermine ego clinging or whatever, or thinking in terms of my ego does this or my ego does that or whatever, we can inadvertently create more self. Yeah, we can create more ego, as it were. In his book called Living Wisely, Bhante talks about this. He says, the language we use can be less than helpful when it comes to the ego. Expressions like transcending the ego can create a lot of confusion by apparently fixing something non-existent in the form of an apparent object of knowledge. The result is nonsensical. We talk about getting rid of something that never existed, or even denying this object of intense interest and concern any reality at all. So the ego, we say, is not real. If we're not careful, we can spend a lot of time talking about something that does not exist in such a way it becomes more real to us than it was before we started making so much of it. Yeah. And of course, Bhante's remedy for this is, as usual, quite clear and simple. Yeah. And this is the central bit of my talk, by the way. This is the most important bit of my talk. Yeah. And it's from Bhante, not from me. If our gut feeling is that we have or are a self, it can feel as if the Dharma is going to take something away from us that is central to who we are. When in fact the Dharma is there to help us see ourselves, whatever we may be, more clearly. Instead of challenging ourselves to explode our deluded conception of the self directly, it may be more helpful to think of breaking out of the closed circle of self-interest that is the emotional expression of our delusion. We can think of expanding that circle through the cultivation of metta or loving kindness, until our self-interest is absorbed in a concern for the welfare of all living beings. Overcoming ego is not just an idea, it's an experience, a way of life. So we want to be aware of our ego identity, in the sense of being aware of when we are closed in on ourselves, yeah? When we're too self-concerned or self-obsessed or whatever. But at the same time, we want to avoid that awareness, as it were, becoming another form of self-centeredness or self-obsession. Do you see the point I'm making? So we want to be aware of something. We can be aware of the fact that we're greedy, or that we dislike people, or we get annoyed, or we get angry, or whatever. We can be aware of that, but you don't want to become so aware of it that actually that itself becomes a kind of self-centeredness. Yeah. Subhuti says the ego is a way of behaving, a kind of revolving on our own axis. Yeah. And to free ourselves from this, we need to behave differently. We need to behave more expansively. As Bhante puts it, by going out of yourself, by orbiting around something bigger than yourself. And then Bhante goes on to say, instead of saying that the ego does not exist or that it's not real, you could say instead that to be constantly turning in upon yourself is not the most satisfying form of existence. Yeah? There are better options available to you. Instead of saying to yourself, just drop the ego, you can say, let yourself open up a little, or even let yourself go. To the extent that you think of others with genuine concern, you are non-egotistic. Yeah? Even if you're just thinking of your own family, that is an important step towards being non-egotistic. Thinking about your family is certainly a more effective way of beginning to realize the truth than just reading about it and understanding it intellectually. So in the Buddhist tradition, there are ways of working with this whole area of our ego identity, our sense of self, and so on. There are various methods and practices. We've already mentioned loving kindness, metta. All of us, I think, know the metta bhavana practice and so on. There are lots of meditations on Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, which are doing the same thing. For me, it has been the Ratnasambhava practice over years. That's the practice I've done, meditating on the Buddha Ratnasambhava, which is all about expansiveness and abundance and richness. There's also the practice of exchanging self for other in different forms. There's a bodhicitta practice, tonglen, brahmaviharas, practices like that. So because self-view or ego identity is a delusion, other view, how we see others, is also a delusion. Because, well, we do fix other people as well. In fact, often we fix other people more than we fix ourselves, as it were. So we turn other people into much more of a kind of ego identity, even than perhaps they experience themselves. Yeah. And because because of the nature of reality, the implication of realizing this reality is that we become naturally compassionate. So if we realize that we ourselves are a process, as it were, that we don't have anything fixed, that we need to protect or defend or aggrandize, and other people are the same. Other people are just like us in that respect. We're connected to other people by the nature of reality. If we realize that, then the natural outcome of that is compassionate attitudes and behaviors. Yeah. By practicing compassion in the form of exchange of self for others and developing empathy and so on, we begin to embody this wisdom, the wisdom of the law of conditionality. So if we come back to the theme of spiritual friendship, perhaps it's obvious that if we're to practice exchange of self for other, we have to begin with those others who are closest to us. Yes, so it's not an intellectual exercise. It's not about something you do, as it were, in the privacy of your own living room, and then it doesn't have any effect. It's about actually practicing something in your life. Yeah, there's no point in making the practice more difficult than it has to be. It should, in a sense, be easier to practice exchanging self for other with close friends. Yeah. And then in time we may be able to extend it out further and further until it encompasses, well, all beings, as it were. But we shouldn't imagine or delude ourselves that we're able to practice the exchange of self for other on a universal basis. We have to start with our friends, yeah? Subhuti puts it, we can start to practice the exchange of self and other simply by being more and more mindful of the needs of our friends and putting their needs before our own, in a way. I was just thinking, what we're talking about is trying to move from a sense of I or me to we, yeah, or us. That's what we're talking about. So when you come into a room or come into the Buddhist center or whatever, often our experience is of how this feels for me, or it might even be what's here for me or whatever. It's not necessarily a thought out thing, but that's the experience often, any situation we're in. It's about how is this for me or whatever. What we're trying to move towards is more an experience, a genuine, authentic experience, where actually what you're experiencing is how is this for us? How is this, you know, we are doing this, we are... you could even say we, as I said at the beginning, we're all here for this talk. We're all participating in this talk just now. It's not just me giving a talk. It's us participating in something. It's us exploring something together. I'm assuming that's what's happening. I don't really know, but I'm assuming. Yeah. So any motivation to spiritual practice has to include some spark of compassion. Any motivation to spiritual practice. So those who see and experience the human predicament as a spiritual problem already have enough imagination, as it were, to see that it's not just their personal predicament. Yeah. If somebody considered what's a universal predicament to be their very own predicament, you know, the fact that they're going to die or something like that, if they saw that as just my predicament, then they would look for answers to that wouldn't work. Yeah. And if you didn't have the imagination to see the predicament at all, well, you wouldn't look for any answers. Yeah. So the fact that we do to some degree see the predicament probably means that we see it's not just our predicament. It's a universal predicament. And that, in that realization, is already the seeds of compassion. Yeah. So Siddhartha was motivated by his own suffering, his mental suffering, psychological suffering, existential suffering. But he also saw that his predicament was a universal problem. So there was that spark of compassion was there in his quest right from the beginning. And I think most of us will have something of that experience, even if we're only dimly aware of it. And after his enlightenment, the Buddha's life is all about sharing his insights with others and doing what he can to help them to alleviate their suffering. So compassionate activity is the expression of the wisdom that sees the impermanence and insubstantiality of self and others. So we can have wonderful experiences in meditation, wonderful peak experiences in meditation, but unless they manifest in the world as friendly, kindly activity, they're really of no significance. Yeah? They're no more significant than getting drunk unless they really manifest in the world as some kind of kindly, friendly activity. You can study the Pali Canon, you can study the Sanskrit Sutras, you can study Tibetan Buddhism, but unless it leads to friendly, kindly activity in the world, it's not significant. It's no more significant than reading a newspaper. Buddhism makes no sense without compassion. Or putting it more explicitly in terms of the topic I'm talking about, Buddhism makes no sense without Kalyanamitrata. This is another quote from Bhante from his book Living with Kindness. He says, metta and insight are not separate aims. Indeed, metta is a necessary aspect of insight. And with reflection on the real nature of metta, insight will shine through. Having developed metta in a limited sense, as an equal kindness towards others, you can go on to reflect on whether there is really any difference between yourself and others, and if so, what that difference might be. And in reflecting in this way, you will begin to see that the idea that I am I, and he is he, and she, is no more than a delusion. And in that way, metta begins to blend with insight. When metta is experienced in this fully expansive mode and is universal in its scope, there is no experience of a self that is separate from anyone or anything else. To speak of oneself at this stage is almost a contradiction in terms. Forgetting the self as a reference point, no longer asking what any given situation means to you alone, you can go on indefinitely and happily expanding the breadth and depth of your interest and positivity. So forgetting the self as a reference point, no longer asking what any given situation means for you alone, you can go on indefinitely and happily expanding the breadth and depth of your interest and positivity. So just to be clear, this doesn't mean leaving yourself out, if you see what I mean. It's equalizing self and others. It's not leaving yourself out. Somebody used the phrase, it's not speed bump compassion. Speed bump is where you are the speed bump and everything else drives over you, as it were. It's not that. It's that you're not the doormat kind of thing. You are as important as others. Others are as important as you. That's the point, yeah? So Kalyanamitrata, whether it's spiritual friendship, whether it's vertical or horizontal, whether we're guiding or teaching others, learning from others, or being mutually supportive, it's all part of the flow of compassionate activity. And that's why it's the whole of the spiritual life. At the beginning, we can only be receptive. Our motivation for wanting to learn has within it the spark of compassion, but we can only be receptive. We're learning. And the unease, the unsatisfactoriness, the dukkha that propels us to take up the spiritual quest is not just a purely personal unease. It's an intuitive sense that life has meaning beyond our current understanding and experience. And with a bit of luck, or perhaps merit, we find someone or we find a group to teach us the path and put our yearnings into a context. And our first experiences of Kalyanamitrata are of being helped by those more experienced. Yeah. And each one of us could probably make a list of all the people who've helped us to get started on the path or helped us along the way. Some of them may not have had much more understanding than ourselves, and some may have had vastly more understanding. Some we may have met only through books or videos or whatever, and some we may have had a very personal relationship with. I can immediately bring to mind loads of people who've helped me and looked out for me, especially in those early years when I was troubled and torn and all the rest of it, not very integrated or aware. And they all acted in a selfless way, with great kindness, and they got precious little back from me. Yeah, yeah. I was so self-obsessed and troubled by my own psychological conflicts and so on. They got precious little back from me. So that was my first experiences of Kalyanamitrata, but I was largely unaware of it, yeah? Mainly unaware of it, and even ungrateful, sometimes possibly even resentful for helping me. It's only later that I realized how much people had done for me, yeah? And experienced a great deal of gratitude. So that's one of the things I try to do now, is to be aware of the benefits I'm receiving from other people, what's being done by others that benefits me. They may not even be trying to benefit me, but I'm a recipient of a lot of selfless acts on the part of many people. Sometimes I find myself receiving help in my spiritual practice from people who don't know that they're helping me. I might be inspired by someone's enthusiasm, yeah, or chastened by their ethical sensitivity, or encouraged to reflect more deeply by their questions or something like that. So Kalyanamitrata is the living out, spiritual friendship is the living out of the compassionate project of Buddhism. This project, if we want to call it that, of friendly and kindly activity. And for all of us, it means sharing our experience of living the spiritual life, whether in groups of various kinds, in one-to-one conversations, or in formal teaching situations. Our participation in the life of the spiritual community can be Kalyanamitrata, it can be spiritual friendship. Our participation in the life of the Nottingham Buddhist Centre can be Kalyanamitrata. All our interactions have the potential to be spiritual friendship. It's worth reflecting that actually, without spiritual community, without spiritual friendship, we could have no access to the Dharma or the Buddha. It's only through that flow of teaching down over the generations from through people who have experienced something, who are sharing their experience over the last 2,500 years. It's only through that, really, that we have access to the living Dharma, to the living Buddhist life. Yeah? Which is another reason for saying that Kalyanamitrata is the whole of the spiritual life. So finally, I'm going to finish with this. I'm going to finish with another quote from Bhante, which sums up this whole topic with his characteristic clarity and simplicity. This is a quote from The Essential Sangharakshita, that book. He says, "The brahmacharya, or spiritual life, is that way of life that leads to the brahmaloka, or spiritual world. But how is it able to do this? To fully answer, we must turn to yet another early Buddhist text. In the Mahagavinda Sutta, we find in it this very question being asked. How does a mortal reach the immortal Brahma world? In other words, how can one cross from the transient to the eternal? And the answer given is quite short and simple. One reaches the Brahma world by giving up all possessive thoughts, all thoughts of me and mine. In other words, one reaches the Brahma loka by giving up egotism and selfishness, by giving up all sense of I. Thus, the intimate connection between spiritual friendship and spiritual life starts to come into focus. Spiritual friendship is a training in unselfishness, in egolessness. You share everything with your friends. You speak to them kindly and affectionately and show concern for their welfare, especially their spiritual welfare. You treat them in the same way you treat yourself. That is, you treat them as being equal with yourself. You relate to them with the attitude of metta, not according to where the power lies between you. Learning to relate to our friends in this way, we will gradually learn to respond to the whole world with metta, with unselfishness. It is in this way that spiritual friendship is indeed the whole of the spiritual life.